Chapter 47. Memory which returned first upon them was that of their happy arrival on a similar afternoon, the first fresh sense of sharing a habitation conjointly, the first meal together, the chatting by the fire with joined hands. The farmer and his wife were in the field at the moment of his visit, and Claire was in the rooms alone for some time. Inwardly swollen with a renewal of sentiment that he had not quite reckoned with, he went upstairs to her chamber, which had never been his. The bed was smooth as he had made it with her own hands on the morning of leaving. The mistletoe hung under the tester just as he had placed it. Having been there 3 or 4 weeks, it was turning color, and the leaves and berries were wrinkled. Angel took it down, and crushed it into the grate. Standing there, he for the first time doubted whether his course in this conjecture had been a wise, much less a generous, one. But had he not been cruelly blinded? In the incoherent multitude of his emotions, he knelt down at the bedside wet-eyed. "Tess, if you had only told me sooner, I would have forgiven you," he mourned. Hearing a footstep below, he rose and went to the top of the stairs. At the bottom of the flight he saw a woman standing, and on her turning up her face recognized the pale, dark-eyed Is Hewitt. "Mr. Clare," she said, "I've called to see you and Mrs. Clare, and to inquire if he be well. I thought you might be back here again." This was a girl whose secret he had guessed, but who had not yet guessed his. An honest girl who loved him, one who would have made as good, or nearly as good, a practical farmer's wife as Tess. "I am here alone," he said. "We are not living here now." Explaining why he had come, he asked, "Which way are you going home, Is?" "I have no home at Talbothay's Dairy now, sir," she said. "Why is that?" Is looked down. "It was so dismal there that I left. I am staying out this way." She pointed in a contrary direction, the direction in which he was journeying. "Well, are you going there now? I can take you, if you wish for a lift." Her olive complexion grew richer in hue. "Thank'ee, Mr. Clare," she said. He soon found the farmer, and settled the account for his rent, and the few other items which had to be considered by reason of the sudden abandonment of the lodgings. On Clare's return to his horse, and Gig Is jumped up beside him. "I am going to leave England, Is," he said, as they drove on. "Going to Brazil." "And do Mrs. Clare like the notion of such a journey?" she asked. "She is not going at present, say for a year or so. I am going out to reconnoiter to see what life there is like." They sped along eastward for some considerable distance, Is making no observation. "How are the others?" he inquired. "I was ready." She was in a sort of nervous state when I zid her last, and so thin, and hollow-cheeked, that I do seem in a decline. "Nobody will ever fall in love with her anymore," said Is absently. "And Marion?" Is lowered her voice. "Marion drinks."
"Indeed?"
"Yes. The dairyman has got rid of her."
"And you?"
"I don't drink, and I bain't in a decline. But I am no great things at singing afore breakfast now."
"How is that?"
"Do you remember how neatly you used to turn 'twas down in Cupid's gardens, and the tailor's breeches at morning milking?"
"Ah, yes.
When you first came, sir, that was. Not when you had been there a bit. Why was that falling off?" Her black eyes flashed up to his face for one moment by way of answer.
"Is, how weak of you for such as I," he said, and fell into reverie.
"And suppose I had asked you to marry me? If you had, I should have said yes, and you would have married a woman who loved thee."
"Really?"
"Down to the ground," she whispered vehemently. "My God, did you never guess it till now?" By and by they reached a branch road to a village. "I must get down. I live out there," said Is abruptly, never having spoken since her avowal. Claire slowed the horse. He was incensed against his fate, bitterly disposed towards social ordinances. For they had cooped him up in a corner, out of which there was no legitimate pathway. Why not be revenged on society, by shaping his future domesticities loosely, instead of kissing the pedagogic rod of convention in this ensnaring manner?
I am going to Brazil alone, is, said he. Have separated from my wife for personal, not voyaging, reason. I may never live with her again. I may not be able to love you, but will you go with me instead of her? You truly wish me to go? I do. I have been badly used enough to wish for relief. And you at least love me disinterestedly. Yes, I will go, said Iz, after a pause. You will? You know what it means, Iz? It means that I shall live with you for the time you are over there. That's good enough for me. Remember, you are not to trust me in morals now. But I ought to remind you that it will be wrongdoing in the eyes of civilization, Western civilization, that is to say. I don't mind that. No woman do when it comes to agony point, and there's no other way. Then don't get down, but sit where you are. He drove past the crossroads, 1 mile, 2 miles, without showing any signs of affection. You love me very, very much, is? He suddenly asked. I do, I have said I do. I loved you all the time we was at the dairy together. More than Tess? She shook her head. No, she murmured, not more than she. How's that? Because nobody could love E more than Tess did. ... She would have laid down her life for E. I could do no more. Like the prophet on the top of pier, is Hewitt would fain have spoken perversely at such a moment, but the fascination exercised over her rougher nature by Tess's character compelled her to grace. Claire was silent. His heart had risen at these straightforward words from such an unexpected, unimpeachable quarter. In his throat was something as if a sob had solidified there. His ear repeated, she would have laid down her life for E. I could do no more. Forget our idle talk, is, he said, turning the horse's head suddenly. Don't know what I've been saying. I will now drive you back to where your lane branches off. So much for honesty towards E. Oh, how can I bear it? How can I? Is Hewitt burst into wild tears, and beat her forehead as she saw what S. he had done. Do you regret that poor little act of justice to an absent one? Oh, Is, don't spoil it by regret. She stilled herself by degrees. Very well, sir. Perhaps I didn't know what I was saying either, WH, when I agreed to go. I wish what cannot be. Because I have a loving wife already. Yes, yes. You have. They reached the corner of the lane which they had passed half an hour earlier, and she hopped down. Is, please, please forget my momentary levity, he cried. It was so ill-considered, so ill-advised. Forget it? Never, never. Oh, it was no levity to me. He felt how richly he deserved the reproach that the wounded cry conveyed, and, in a sorrow that was inexpressible, leapt down and took her hand. Well, but, Is, we'll part friends, anyhow. You don't know what I've had to bear. She was a really generous girl, and allowed no further bitterness to mar their adieu. I forgive E, sir, she said. Now, Is, he said, while she stood beside him there, forcing himself to the mentor's part he was far from feeling, I want you to tell Marion when you see her that she is to be a good woman, and not to give way to folly. Promise that, and tell Reddy that there are more worthy men than I in the world, that for my sake she is to act wisely and well. Remember the words wisely and well for my sake. I send this message to them as a dying man to the dying, for I shall never see them again. And you, Izzy, you have saved me by your honest words about my wife from an incredible impulse towards folly and treachery. Women may be bad, but they are not so bad as men in these things. On that one account I can never forget you. Be always the good and sincere girl you have hitherto been, and think of me as a worthless lover, but a faithful friend. Promise. She gave the promise. Heaven bless and keep you, sir. Goodbye. He drove on, but no sooner had Iz turned into the lane, and Claire was out of sight, than she flung herself down on the bank in a fit of racking anguish. And it was with a strained, unnatural face that she entered her mother's cottage late that night. Nobody ever was told how it spent the dark hours that intervened between Angel Claire's parting from her and her arrival home. Claire, too, after bidding the girl farewell, was wrought to aching thoughts and quivering lips. But his sorrow was not for his. That evening he was within a featherweight's turn of abandoning his road to the nearest station, and driving across that elevated dorsal line of South Wessex which divided him from his Tess's home. It was neither a contempt for her nature, nor the probable state of her heart, which deterred him. No, it was a sense that, despite her love, as corroborated by Iz's admission, the facts had not changed. If he was right at first, he was right now. And the momentum of the course on which he had embarked tended to keep him going in it, unless diverted by a stronger, more sustained force than had played upon him this afternoon. He could soon come back to her. He took the train that night for London, and 5 days after shook hands in farewell of his brothers at the port of embarkation. XLI, from the foregoing events of the winter time, let us press on to an October day, more than 8 months subsequent to the parting of Claire and Tess. We discover the latter in changed conditions. Instead of a bride with boxes and trunks which others bore, we see Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.